So welcome to Beta Level, and this is basically like the first interview of our second year doing LA Lit. We had like a LA Lit one-year anniversary party a couple weeks ago, and if you go to our website, la-lit.com, you can listen to all of last year's interviews. We had people like Diane Ward, Will Alexander, Ara Sharanian, Stan Apps, Jane Sprague, Jen Hoffer, Julian Poirier from Ugly Duckling Press, and Matt Vey, Yankelevich, and Anna Moskovakis, also from Ugly Duckling Press, and Douglas Kearney, who has a book out on Red Hen that just came out like right now. And I think he's up at Small Press Traffic this weekend reading, and Amarnath Rava. So we have a lot of great writers, from mostly from the L.A. area. And we have, this year, I guess we're going to be interviewing Teresa Carmody from Les Figues Press on November 19th. Soon after, we'll be doing Vanessa Place, also from Les Figues Press, who has a book out called Die is a Sentence, which is a beautiful book. It's just one long sentence, like big, thick sentence. Sawako Nakayasu is going to be December 10th, and we're going to have about seven poets from the Bay Area down here doing a discussion about a kind of important anthology that came out recently called Bay Poetics that, Ron Silliman on his blog just went off about how beautiful it was and all that, and yeah. We'll have a lot going on down here, so you guys should check it out. But otherwise, I guess we'll go ahead and get started.
Are we on?
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to LA Lit. LA Lit is a literary interview show that interviews LA-based writers and those from elsewhere who might be passing through the city. We podcast all our interviews, and you can find them at www.la-lit.com. We are sponsored by Superbunker, which is at www.superbunker.com, and hosted here at Beta Level, www.betalevel.com. I'm Stephanie Ryu.
And I'm Matthew Timmons, and we're here with Chris Krause tonight. Chris Krause, a Los Angeles-based writer, and her books include I Love Dick, Aliens and Anorexia, Video Green, Los Angeles Art and the Triumph of Nothingness, and Torpor, most recently. In 2003, Krause was cited by the Village Voice Literary Supplement as one of the most important new writers to emerge in the past decade. In 1990, she founded the Native Agents New Fiction Series for Semiotext, the visionary independent press founded by Sylvaire Lautringer at Columbia University in 1972. Krause writes about art and culture for many international publications, including Index, Art Text, and Art in America. And she was nominated for the 2005 Frank Mather Prize in Art Criticism and is presently the writer-in-residence at Columbia College of Art in Chicago. So, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah. And I think we're just going to start with the reading from I Love Dick, the beginning of I Love Dick. So if you want to say a little bit about it.
Okay, yeah. I Love Dick came out in 1997. And I didn't really know when I wrote I Love Dick that I was writing a book. I didn't set out to write a book. In fact, I started writing very late. And the only reason, I guess, that I ever did start writing was because I started writing these crazy letters to someone named Dick. So everything that's written in the book is true, but of course it's also false because as soon as you write something down, it's fiction. It's something else. It's not exactly literal truth. I wrote the letters for over a long period of time, over about a year and a half. And I think that if this person, Dick, had ever actually written me a letter back or responded in any real life way, there wouldn't have been a book. I would have just stopped writing and talked on the phone or talked in person. But since he didn't, and neither did he tell me to stop writing them, his silence became this kind of blank screen that I could write on. And there's nothing better for writing, I believe, than silence. It's so inviting of you to speak. And once I started writing the letters, I realized that I had a great deal of stuff that I wanted to talk about that I needed to say, and I couldn't stop writing. Eventually, when he didn't write back, I realized that I had, in fact, written a book. And then this other part of the work began, you know, which was the work of taking all of this crazy writing and shaping it into a book. So while the book has often been read as very loose and very, confessional, it's really not. You know, I see the book as being extremely composed and extremely deliberate. And if I sound like a crazy person in the passages that I read, it's only because I kind of decided to write behind the mask of a stalker. So let me start. From the beginning. Scenes from a Marriage, December 3rd, 1994. Chris Krause, a 39-year-old experimental filmmaker, and Silver Lotringer, a 56-year-old college professor from New York, have dinner with Dick Blank, a friendly acquaintance of Silver's at a sushi bar in Pasadena. Dick is an English cultural critic who's recently relocated from Melbourne to Los Angeles. Chris and Silver have spent Silver's sabbatical at a cabin in Crestline, a small town in the San Bernardino Mountains, some 90 minutes from Los Angeles. Since Silver begins teaching again in January, they will soon be returning to New York. Over dinner, the two men discuss recent trends in postmodern critical theory. And Chris, who is no intellectual, notices Dick making continual eye contact with her. Dick's attention makes her feel powerful. And when the check comes, she takes out her Diners Club card. "Please," she says, "let me pay." The radio predicts snow on the San Bernardino Highway. Dick generously invites them both to spend the night at his home in the Antelope Valley Desert, some 30 miles away. Chris wants to separate herself from her coupleness, so she sells Silver on the thrill of riding in Dick's magnificent vintage Thunderbird convertible. Silver, who doesn't know a T-bird from a hummingbird and doesn't care, agrees, bemused. Dick gives her copious concern directions. "Don't worry," she interrupts, flashing hair and smiles. "I'll tail you." And she does. Slightly buzzed and keeping the accelerator of her pickup truck steady, she's reminded of a performance she did called Car Chase at the St. Mark's Poetry Project in New York when she was 23. She and her friend Liza Martin had tailed the steelily good-looking driver of a Porsche all the way through Connecticut on Highway 95. Finally, he'd pulled over at a rest stop, but when Liza and Chris got out, he drove off. The performance ended with Liza accidentally but really stabbing Chris's hand on stage with a kitchen knife. Blood flowed, and everyone found Liza dazzlingly sexy and dangerous and beautiful. Liza, belly popping out of a fuzzy midriff top, fishnet legs tearing up against her green vinyl miniskirt as she rocked back to show her crotch, looked like the cheapest kind of whore. A star is born. No one at the show that night had found Chris's pale, anemic looks and piercing gaze remotely endearing. Could anyone? It was a question that had temporarily been shelved. But now it was a whole new world. The beat 92.3 was thumping post-riot Los Angeles, a city strung on fiber optic nerves. Dick's Thunderbird was always somewhere in her line of sight. The two vehicles strung invisibly together across the concrete riverbed of highway like John Donne's eyeballs. And this time, Chris was alone. Back at Dick's, the night unfolds like the boozy Christmas Eve in Eric Rohmer's film My Night at Maud's. Chris notices that Dick is flirting with her, his vast intelligence straining beyond the Pomo rhetoric and words to evince some essential loneliness that only she and he can share. Chris giddily responds. At 2 a.m., Dick plays them a video of himself dressed as Johnny Cash, commissioned by English Public Television. He's talking about earthquakes and upheaval and his restless longing for a place called home. Chris's response to Dick's video, though she does not articulate it at the time, is complex. As an artist, she finds Dick's work hopelessly naive. Yet she is a lover of certain kinds of bad art, art which offers a transparency into the hopes and desires of the person who made it. Bad art makes the viewer much more active. Years later, Chris would realize that her fondness for bad art is exactly like Jane Eyre's attraction to Rochester, a mean horse-faced junkie. Bad character invites invention. But Chris keeps these thoughts to herself. Because she does not express herself in theoretical language, no one expects too much from her, and she's used to tripping out on layers of complexity and total silence. Chris's unarticulated double flip on Dick's video draws her even closer to him. She dreams about him all night long. But when Chris and Silver wake up on the sofa bed the next morning, Dick is gone. December 4th, 1994, 10 a.m. Silver and Chris leave Dick's house reluctantly alone that morning. Chris rises to the challenge of extemporizing the thank you note, which must be left behind. She and Silver have breakfast at the Antelope Valley IHOP. Because they are no longer having sex, the two maintain their intimacy via deconstruction, i.e., they tell each other everything. Chris tells Silvera how she believes that she and Dick have just experienced a conceptual fuck. His disappearance in the morning clinches it and invests it with a subcultural subtext she and Dick both share. She's reminded of all the fuzzy one-time fucks she's had with men who are out the door before her eyes are open. She writes a she recites a poem by Barbara Barg on this subject to Silvera. What do you do with a Kerouac but go back and back to the sack with Jack? How do you know when Jack has come? You look on your pillow and Jack is gone. And then there was the message on Dick's answer phone. When they came into the house, Dick took his coat off, poured them drinks, and hit the play button. The voice of a very young, very Californian woman came on. Hi, Dick, this is Kyla. Dick, I'm sorry to keep calling you at home, and now I've got your answering machine, and I just wanted to say how I'm sorry things didn't work out the other night, and I know it's not your fault, but I guess all I really wanted to say was just thank you for being such a nice person. Now I'm totally embarrassed, Dick mumbled charmingly, opening the vodka. Dick is 46 years old. Does this message mean he's lost? And if Dick is lost, could he be saved by entering a conceptual romance with Chris? Was the conceptual fuck merely the first step? For the next few hours, Silvera and Chris discuss this. December 4th, 1994, 8 p.m. Back in Crestline, Chris can't stop thinking about last night with Dick. So she starts to write a story about it called Abstract Romanticism. It's the first story she's written in years. It started in the restaurant, she begins. It was the beginning of the evening, and we were all laughing a bit too much. She addresses this story intermittently to David Rattray because she's convinced that David's ghost had been with her last night for the car ride, pushing her pickup truck further all the way up Highway 5. Chris, David's ghost in the truck, had merged into a single unit moving forward. Last night I felt, she wrote to David's ghost, like I do at times when things seem to open onto new vistas of excitement, that you were here, floating dense beside me, set someplace between my left ear and my shoulder, compressed like thought. She thought about David all the time. It was uncanny how Dick had said somewhere in last night's boozy conversation, as if he'd read her mind, how much he admired David's book. David Rattray had been a reckless adventurer and a genius and a moralist, indulging in the most improbable infatuations nearly until the moment of his death at age 57. And now Chris felt David's ghost pushing her to understand infatuation, how the loved person can become a holding pattern for all the tattered ends of memory, experience, and thought you've ever had. So she started to describe Dick's face, pale and mobile, good bones, reddish hair, and deep-set eyes. Writing, Chris held her face in his mind. And then the telephone rang, and it was Dick. Chris was so embarrassed. She wondered if the call was really for Silvera, but Dick didn't ask for him, so she stayed on the scratchy line. Dick was phoning to explain his disappearance the night before. He'd gotten up early and drove out to Pear Blossom to pick up some eggs and bacon. I'm a bit of an insomniac, you know. When he'd gotten home to Antelope Valley, he was genuinely surprised to find them gone. At this moment, Chris could have told Dick her own far-fetched interpretations. Had she, the story would have taken another turn. But there was so much static on the line, and already she was afraid of him. She feverishly considered proposing another meeting, but she didn't. And then Dick got off the phone. Chris stood in her makeshift office, sweating. Then she ran upstairs to find Silvera. December 5th, 1994. Alone in Crestline, Silvera and Chris spent most of last night, Sunday, and this morning, Monday, talking about Dick's three-minute call. Why does Silvera entertain this? It could be that for the first time since last summer, Chris seems animated and alive, and since he loves her, Silvera can't bear to see her sad. It could be he's reached an impasse with the book he's writing on modernism and the Holocaust and dreads returning next month to his teaching job. It could be that he's perverse. December 6th through 8th, 1994. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of this week pass unrecorded, blurred. If memory serves, Tuesday that term was the day that Chris Krause and Sivra Lotringer spent in Pasadena teaching at Art Center College of Design. Shall we attempt a reconstruction? They get up at 8, drive down the hill from Crestline, grab coffee in San Bernardino, hop on the 215 to the 10 and drive for 90 minutes, hitting L.A. just after traffic. It's likely they talked about Dick for most of the ride. However, since they plan to move out of Crestline in just 10 days on December 14th, Sylvia to Paris for the holidays, Chris to New York, they must have also briefly talked logistics. A restless longing, driving through Fontana and Pomona through a landscape that meant nothing, with an inconclusive future looming. While Sylvia lectured on post-structuralism, Chris drove out to Hollywood and shopped for cheese at Trader Joe's. Then they drove back out to Crestline, winding up the mountain through darkness and thick fog. Wednesday and Thursday disappear. It's obvious that Chris's new film isn't going to go very far. What will she do next? Her first experience in art had been as a participant in some druggy psychodramas of the 70s. The idea that Dick may have proposed a kind of game between them is incredibly exciting. She explains it over and over to Sylvia. She begs Sylvia to phone him, fish around for some idea that Dick's aware of her, and if there is, she'll call. Friday, December 9th, 1994. Sylvia, a European intellectual who teaches Proust, is skilled in the analysis of love's minutiae. But how long can anyone continue analyzing a single evening in a 3-minute call? Already, Sylvia's left 2 unanswered messages on Dick's answer phone. And Chris has turned into a jumpy bundle of emotions, sexually aroused for the first time in 7 years. So on Friday morning, Sylvia finally suggests that Chris write Dick a letter. Since she's embarrassed, she asks him if he wants to write one too. Sylvia agrees. Do married couples usually collaborate on billets doux? If Sylvia and Chris were not so militantly opposed to psychoanalysis, they might have seen this as a turning point. Exhibit A, Chris and Sylvia's first letters. Crestline, California, December 9th, 1994. Dear Dick, it must be the desert wind that went to our heads that night, or maybe the desire to fictionalize life a little bit, I don't know. We've met a few times, and I felt a lot of sympathy towards you and a desire to be closer. Though we come from different places, we've both tried breaking up with our pasts. You're a cowboy. For 10 years, I was a nomad in New York. So let's go back to that evening at your house, the glorious ride in your Thunderbird from Pasadena to the end of the world, I mean the Antelope Valley. It's a meeting we postponed for almost a year, and truer than I imagined. But how did I get into that? I wanted to talk about that evening at your house. I had a feeling that somehow I knew you and we could just be what we are together. But now I'm sounding like the bimbo whose voice we heard unwittingly that night on your answer phone. Sylvia. Crestline, California, December 9th, 1994. Dear Dick, since Sylvia wrote the first letter, I'm thrown into this weird position, reactive, like Charlotte Stant to Sylvia's Maggie Verver if we were living in the Henry James novel The Golden Bowl. The dumb cunt, a factory of emotions evoked by all the men. So the only thing that I can do is tell the dumb cunt's tale. But how? Sylvia thinks it's nothing more than a perverse longing for rejection, the love I feel for you. But I disagree. At bottom, I'm a very romantic girl. What touched me were all the windows of vulnerability in your house, so Spartan and self-conscious. The propped up Some Girls album cover, the dusky walls, how out of date and déclassé. But I'm a sucker for despair, for faltering. That moment when the act breaks down, ambition fails. I love it and feel guilty for perceiving it, and then the warmest indescribable affection floods in to drown the guilt. For years, I adored Shake Murphy in New Zealand for these reasons, a hopeless case. But you're not exactly hopeless. You have a reputation, self-awareness, and a job. And so it occurred to me that there might be something to be learned by both of us from playing out this romance in a mutually self-conscious way. Abstract romanticism? It's weird. I never really wondered whether I'm your type. Because in the past, empirical romance, since I'm not pretty or maternal, I never am the type for cowboy guys. But maybe action's all that really matters now. What people do together overshadows who they are. If I can't make you fall in love with me for who I am, maybe I can interest you with what I understand. So instead of wondering, would he like me? I wonder, is he game? When you called on Sunday night, I was writing a description of your face. I couldn't talk and hung up on the bottom end of the romantic equation with beating heart and sweaty palms. It's incredible to feel this way. For 10 years, my life's been organized around avoiding this painful elemental state. I wish that I could dabble like you do around romantic myths, but I can't because I always, and already in the course of this 3-day totally fictitious romance, I've started getting sick. And I wonder if there'll ever be a possibility of reconciling youth and age, or the anorexic open wound I used to be, with the money-hustling hag that I've become. We suicide ourselves for our own survival. Is there any hope of dipping back into the past and circling round it like you do in art? Silvaire, who's typing this, says this letter lacks a point. What reaction am I looking for? He thinks this letter's too literary, too Baudrillardian. He says I'm squashing out all the trembly lyrical things he found so touching. It's not the dumb cunt exegesis he expected. But Dick, I know that as you read this, you'll know these things are true. You understand the game is real, or even better than reality. And better than is what it's all about. What sex is better than drugs. What art is better than sex. Better than means stepping out into complete intensity. Being in love with you, being ready to take this ride, made me feel 16, hunched up in a leather jacket in a corner with my friends. A timeless fucking image. It's about not giving a fuck or seeing all the consequences looming and doing something anyway. And I think I keep looking for that, and it's thrilling when you find it in other people. Silvaire thinks he's that kind of anarchist, but he's not. I love you, Dick. Chris.
Okay, so you mentioned in this particular part, and it comes up again in the book, about rejection from men, and Silvaire thinking that this protagonist is only looking for rejection from men, and it's her tragic flaw. But there's a point later in the work where you say that you feel like this problem of rejection is bigger and more cultural than just you. Or the protagonist, let's call her, whatever you want. and then the narrative takes a turn at that point. So I was hoping that you might go back and talk a little bit more about how that rejection is bigger and more cultural.
Why the problem is bigger and more cultural? Well, okay. I decided in the process of writing this book, there's a point where I say it later on that I've decided, like, I have nothing else to lose. You know, I have this failed art career. I'm about to turn 40. I may as well turn my life into a case study. And once a life or once anything becomes a case study, that life becomes a paradigm, right? You put it under a microscope and you're looking at the details of it for the commonalities that radiate out into the larger world. Well, my situation, I found, was, you know, unavoidably female. And, you know, this was not a rhetoric, really, that I'd particularly embraced for the last 10 years. You know, I was an experimental filmmaker, and I was in the art world, and it was, I guess, kind of a post-feminist moment. And, you know, I thought, like, you know, I was making these films, and I was thinking, like, I want to be Guy Debord, I want to be Godard. And I didn't think that, like, my own kind of female person or female experience had anything to do with what I was doing. But when I started writing I Love Dick, I had to kind of look at that experience and see where it had failed and where it had broken down. And I realized that female experience had a great deal to do with it, a And so in doing this case study, I wanted to look at that particular female experience, mine, and then bring it out of myself and into the culture in a bigger way. And so, of course, one of the first things I did was to go back, and CalArts was such a terrific location for all of this to happen, because there is a fantastic art history, including a great feminist art history at CalArts. The people who had the Woman's House also were running a program at CalArts in the 70s, and they did all these great works along Route 136. So I started looking at the careers of these women artists of the 70s, and invariably they were living in teepees, or they'd become mentally ill, or they'd chosen other careers. And you have to wonder why this happens. You know, whereas their contemporaries, Chris Burden, Bruce Nauman, have become, you know, blue chip, incredibly established, household word American artists. What happened to these women? I mean, was it their fault? And I like to believe that, you know, if a failure occurs, it's never entirely with the individual. Certainly the individual is a factor, but you have to look at the circumstances and the expectations that set up that failure. So I really wanted to do some detective work and find out what had happened to those people, because I thought it was a tragedy.
And then can you talk about, clearly you made the choice in this book to begin from the quote abject position, or a position of failure. Like, even in the first pages, you're afraid of Dick, and it's like, in a way, it's like you've got that. I mean, it's like a, you know, a little love triangle where you already feel you're at a loss. You know, you can't have him. But beyond that when you're talking about that position of failure, beside it just being like more widely kind of culturally important, like what does it mean, or what did it mean for you to inhabit that position directly?
Well, failure is incredibly liberating, right? You know, if nobody cares, you don't give a shit anymore either. And you may as well say everything. And I think that's the point at which you can begin.
Right, yeah, all right. Well, okay, and then also on that, it's interesting to me that I feel like this relates, maybe in some way, that, you know, the book is called I Love Dick, and it's like, which announces itself as a kind of like first-person narrative. But then throughout the book, we're constantly shifting. I mean, there is a first-person voice in there in the letters, but only in the letters, you know, pretty much. Otherwise, it shifts even from this reading. It's like we automatically have a distance that is almost implied in the relationship between you and Dick. But so can you talk a little bit about that decision to mix this kind of first-person and this very like kind of distance third?
Yeah, it's like the third person is for the setup.
Right?
It's for the backstory.
Yeah.
It's for placing these people in the world, because if I just publish the letters, you know, I this and I that, and those kind of, you know, wrist-gashing, heart-pouring kind of diatribe, it doesn't mean as much as it does if you contextualize who these people are. He's a Columbia University professor. She's a failed filmmaker. They live in New York City. They travel to LA. As soon as you give the third person stuff, they become characters among other characters. And it's a way of kind of placing them in the community and placing them in the world. And it's much funnier, of course, if you do that. And I think it's also much more meaningful. It, you know, the quote, you know, subjectivity that's in the letters is not the whole story. You know, you want to look at the sort of fabric out of which the subjectivity erupts. And of course, as soon as you put yourself in the third person, there's the opportunity to crack a lot of jokes and to treat yourself like a clown, you know, like a character. So it was just obvious that Chris and Silvera had to be not me and my husband, but Chris and Silvera, you know, these two little clowns moving around. Also, you know, if Dick was Dick, then I would be Chris, you know? I mean, think about that, right? In a narrative, if the writer is really the third-person narrator hiding behind the third-person character name, and all the other people are third-person character names, I don't know. There was a thought there, but I lost it.
Well... Well, I mean, it seems like in that way also Dick becomes a fictionalized character, right? I mean, and then can, I mean, even just the,
yeah,
you know.
Dick becomes, the character Dick becomes as fictionalized as Silvera and Chris. And yeah. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's a power thing.
Yeah.
To fictionalize somebody else, it's an act of domination. The writer does this. As soon as you fictionalize somebody, you compartmentalize and contain them.
Yeah.
So you ought to do it to yourself, too. I mean, it's only fair.
Yeah, and there's that part in the beginning where Silvera realizes that Chris loves Dick. And then it says, upset, betrayed, he writes a story. You know, it's hilarious. He doesn't kill her or yell or smash a cup. He writes a story, right? So in this way, he's going to try to take control of the situation himself. It ends up being a short story, but...
Yeah. So your question, it was about the point where Silvera realizes that this is real?
No, not a question, just a comment about when Dick becomes, he realizes that Chris loves Dick, and then he's upset and betrayed, and instead of freaking out or killing somebody or throwing a cup or something, he writes a story. So I thought that was funny, you know, that this is his response.
Right, yeah. Right, because he's so far into the game now, too, that the only way that they... I mean, there comes a point in the book where they start to communicate each with each other through writing. Right.
Yeah. And the game, too, that you mentioned, what if Dick had been game, was my question. What if he had been game? Because, I mean, he is only to a certain point, right? There's a point in the book where he's got this sort of I won't say no kind of response, which is infuriating.
If Dick had been game, we probably would have made a dumb little video. And that would have been that. We proposed it. Early in the game, we proposed that we would come out to his home with a video camera and video him finding our letters pinned up to his cactus plants with the Christmas lights. But we never did that. And, you know, and so I had to go on writing. And I'm glad that I had to go on writing because I certainly got much further a year later as I continued writing to him and more came out.
Yeah.
Well, and because Dick becomes this blank, this kind of blank canvas that you get to write whatever you like on, it's interesting how this book engages with a certain sort of like literary romantic fiction or even romantic poetry, but it's turned, the gender roles have been turned around. Like, you know, we would have like old white men, you know, in the 1900s, early 1900s, or even mid 19th century, like writing these, you know, grand romantic poems where the subject never gets to answer, right? And here it's like the subject doesn't really answer, but he says like, oh no, don't, you know, whatever, you know, if I won't say no. So it's like he also left the kind of door open. But can you talk a little bit about how, like, the form of this novel being epistolary in form and kind of the way that it's engaging with this kind of, you know, this kind of romantic fiction, like kind of 19th century novels?
Right. Well, I love those books. Of course, the obvious models were Delacroix.
Okay.
You know, Liaisons Dangereuses, yeah. Silvera and Chris being the two aging libertines.
Yeah.
We saw that play. We saw the Heine Mueller version of that play, and we really loved that.
Okay.
But, you know, literature is full of that model. You know, then there's the 18th century trope, you know, with the sort of husbands in the closets, the tales of adultery, the Marivaux model.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, we kind of run the gamut. Then we go back to 5th century Japan, the courtesan novels, Sei Shinogan, Lady Nijo, all the way into, I guess, the 20th century. You know, Dick's kind of bleak existentialist mid-20th century state.
Right, right.
Yeah, Dick as Camus, yeah.
Yeah, Dick as Camus. And you also, you talked, I think in like one of Silvera's letters, he turns it into like a kind of Madame Bovary with Emma and like as your cast as Emma.
Uh-huh.
And I remember seeing, like just reading about this book, I think you said somewhere else where it's like, it is kind of like, you know, it's like if Emma's side of the story or something.
Oh, kind yeah, Giovanni Intra said this great thing. It's
right.
Like Madame Bovary if Emma had written it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, the Madame Bovary story, of course, was like a beautiful model for us, right?
Yeah.
And more, I mean, in a very, very profound way, not just the sort of, doll's house, dissatisfied bored housewife part of the story, but the more on a more complicated psychological level in the book, what happens when Charles is so blindly in love with Emma that he himself falls in love with Rodolphe. Emma's loves afterwards, when Emma suicides, Charles steps into Emma's shoes and he begins to pursue Rodolphe himself. Yeah. He empathizes with the woman to this extraordinary degree. And that was actually what happened between me and Silvère.
Right, okay. So that's, you think that's why you were in love with Dick in the first place? In a way, it's like you're... No, the other way around, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, huh. Interesting. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask on this is, because you mentioned this, like, a kind of, you know, it gets a deep psychological kind of perspective. You say how, like, I think in the book, fairly early on, you say that both you and Silvère aren't interested in the kind of psychoanalytic model, the kind of, like, you know, you can talk it out and there'll be some kind of, you know, cure. Where and throughout the whole book, there's like, you can't cure this kind of, it's, you know, this obsession. It's like you only can encourage it more and more until finally you get a letter at the end, I guess. But can you talk about that as well? The kind of
About the anti-psychoanalytic
bend?
Yeah. Well, that's semiotext, of course.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I mean, that's semiotext, and semiotext is us, so same difference. I mean, what semiotext is really published in all of the French theory that Silvère began publishing over the years is work that is, you know, anti-psychoanalytic and political cultural. So the psychoanalytic approach, of course, is to kind of look within the individual for the answers and for the cure. Whereas, you know, the theoretical line that semiotext takes is to more look at how things operate within the culture.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that I Love Dick functions in that way as well, a little bit?
Well,
I mean, you're not...
Yeah, I mean, isn't that totally what I'm doing,
right,
by turning myself into a paradigm?
Right.
You know, any normal person would just go back into therapy, you know?
Right. Well, do you want to read? There was another section from this book.
Yeah,
that you were going to read.
Yeah, you want to read Joseph Kosuth's birthday party, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, so, can I ask one more question?
Yeah,
real quick. I just was wondering if you have experienced any what you would call misogynist reactions to this, and if so, what?
Have I experienced any
misogynist reactions?
Oh, yes. I mean, the misogynist reaction that lasted for 10 years. The book got a lot of press, but nothing I would call a book review. You know, a book not so much written as secreted. Krauss is a major piece of work. There was topping from the bottom. Lapdog. I mean, it was just hateful.
Yeah.
It was incredibly hateful. And it didn't stop with this book. I mean, when I wrote my next book, Aliens and Anorexia, which was a completely different book, it was more or less a philosophical monograph about Simone Veil. It's a biography of Simone Veil. And I got the same kind of response to Aliens and Anorexia. I mean, people reviewed it as Chris Krauss and Silvère Lautringer. I mean, Silvère wasn't even in Aliens and Anorexia, and people were still, when they wrote about Aliens, were talking about Chris and Silvère. So no, I mean, it's taken like a really long time, and it's only, I think, just in the past year with Torpor that people have started reading my books as books. I mean, this, you know, just because I was trying to play a joke, and just because I adopt this sort of pseudo-confessional mask, people took that very literally. And they thought that this was a completely mindless true confession that had nothing to do with literature.
Yeah, I was going to say that's something that I saw all over the place, is that it was, your book was branded as, oh, this confessional, yeah, this kind of like tirade or whatever. And with, you know, and just the way you write it is, you know, with that first, if it was just all the letters, maybe. But like you said, it's like by placing these people and kind of taking it onto some kind of larger structure, I don't know how, I mean, it doesn't make sense to call it just a confessional, you know?
Well, also, I think it's very dangerous for female writers to put the first person in sex stuff. You can have sex stuff, but it can't be in the first person. And as soon as it's in the first person, it's read as a confession. It's read as an abject memoir. My goal in writing the book was to be able to talk about philosophy and to talk about sex in the first person, like, in the same sentence. I remember at one point I was working on part, and I was like, oh, can I use the words cunt and Kierkegaard in the same sentence? And, you know, my cunt, not just cunt, but my cunt. And I did. As soon as you own anything in the first person, you know, of a volatile, sexual, provocative nature, people read it a different way.
Oh, somebody said it's always read, like any book is always read as the first person is always read as the author. Would you say that? Yeah,
the first person is always read as the author, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is there's a different, when it's a, you know, an obviously male first person, or when it's written as a female first person, it's read.
But the male first person has a dignity that somehow the female first person, if it talks about dirty stuff, is deprived of.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
I think, generally speaking, I think you've proved the point.
Yeah.
It depends how much you own it.
Okay, Joseph Kosey's birthday party.
Yeah. Yeah, let's try that. Do you want to say a little bit about this one?
Yeah.
Where was it? It's like 178. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. At this point in the book, I have left Silvera and I've moved up to our house in upstate New York so that I can better write to Dick uninterrupted. And the letters have stopped being short letters and they've turned into something more like essays. And instead of tearing them off in an evening, I'll spend a couple of weeks on each letter. And at this point, I'm kind of writing art essays because Dick is an art critic, and I think if I'm going to keep his attention, then maybe I need to kind of write essays, you know, like write real critical works as well. So I do that, and I find ways of talking about the things that interest me in art and the culture while at the same time, you know, telling Dick what I'm doing every day and what I'm thinking. So in this letter, one of the things I did that week was I went with Silvera to Joseph Kosuth's 50th birthday party. 2, the birthday party. Inside out, boy, you turn me upside down, inside out, late 70s disco song. Joseph Kosuth's birthday party last January was reported the next day on page 6 of the New York Post. And everything was just as perfect as they said. About 100 guests, a number large enough to fill the room, but small enough for each of us to feel among the intimates, the chosen. Joseph and Cornelia and their child had just arrived from Belgium. Marshall Blonsky, one of Joseph's closest friends and Joseph's staff, had been planning it for weeks. Silvera and I drove down from Thurman. I dropped him off outside the loft, parked the car, and arrived at Joseph's door at the same moment as another woman, also entering alone. Each of us gave our names to Joseph Dorman. Each of us had names that weren't there. Czech Lothringer, I said, Silvera. And sure enough, I was Silvera Lothringer's plus one, and she was someone else's. Riding up the elevator, checking makeup, collars, hair, she whispered, "The last thing you want to feel before walking into one of these things is that you're not invited." And we smiled and wished each other luck and parted at the coat check. But luck was something that I didn't feel much need of because I had no expectations. This was Joseph's party, Joseph's friends, people, mostly men except for female art dealers and us plus ones from the early 80s art world. So I expected to be patronized and ignored. Drinks were at one end of the loft, dinner at the other. David Byrne was wandering around the room, as tall as a Moorish king in a magnificent fur hat. I stood next to Kenneth Broomfield at the bar and said a tentative hello. He hissed and turned away. A tighter grip around the scotch glass, standing there in my dark green Japanese wool dress, high heels and makeup. But look, there's Marshall Blonsky. Marshall greets me at the bar and says that seeing me reminds him of a party we attended some 11 years ago when I was Marshall's date. And of course he would remember, because that party was given by Xavier Fourcade to celebrate the publication of Marshall's book, On Signs, at Xavier's Sutton Place townhouse. It was late winter, early spring, Aquarius or Pisces, and I remember guests tripping past the caterers and staff to walk around the green expanse of daffodils and bunny lawn that separated us from the river. David Sally was there, Umberto Eco was there, together with a stable load of Fourcade's models and a reviewer from the New York Times. At that time, I was living in a tenement on Second Avenue and studying charm as a possible escape. Could I be Marshall Blonsky's perfect date? I'd given up trying to be as sexual as Liza Martin, but I was small, bone thin, with a New Zealand accent trailing off to something that sounded vaguely mid-Atlantic. Perhaps something could be done with this? By then, I'd read enough that no one guessed I'd never been to school. Marshall and I'd been introduced by our mutual friend, Louise Bourgeois. I loved her, and he was fascinated by her iron will and growing fame. It is the ability to sublimate that makes an artist, she once told me. And the only hope for you is marrying a critic or an academic. Otherwise, you'll starve. And in the interest of saving me from poverty, Louise had given me, for this occasion, the perfect dress, a straight wool boucle pumpkin-colored shift, historically important, the dress she'd worn accompanying Robert Rauschenberg to his first opening on East 10th. Most of Marshall's friends were men, critics, psychoanalysts, semioticians, and he liked that he could walk me around the room and I'd perform for them, listening, cracking jokes in their own special language, guiding the conversation back to Marshall's book. So French New Wave. Being weightless and gamine, spitting prettily at rules and institutions, a talking dog without the dreariness of a position to defend. Dear Dick, it hurts me that you think I'm insincere. Nick Zed and I were both interviewed once about our films for English television. Everyone in New Zealand who saw the show told me how they liked Nick better because he was more sincere. Nick was just one thing, a straight, clear line, whorgasm, East Village gore and porn, and I was several, and. And isn't sincerity just a denial of complexity? You as Johnny Cash driving your Thunderbird into the heart of light? What put me off experimental film word feminism, besides all its boring study groups on Jacques Lacan, was its sincere investigation into the dilemma of the pretty girl. As an ugly girl, it didn't matter much to me. And didn't Donna Haraway finally solve this by saying that all female lived experience is a bunch of riffs, completely fake, so we should recognize ourselves as cyborgs? But still, the fact remains. You moved out to the desert on your own to clear the junk out of your life. You're skeptical of irony. You were trying to find some way of living you believe in. I envy this. Jane Bowles described the problem of sincerity in a letter to her husband, Paul, the better writer. August 1947. Dearest Bupple, the more I get into it, the more isolated I feel vis-a-vis the writers whom I consider to be of any serious mind. I am enclosing this article entitled New Heroes by Simone de Beauvoir. Read the sides that are marked pages 121 and 123. It is what I have been thinking at the bottom of my mind all the time, and God knows it is difficult to write the way I do and yet think their way. This problem you will never have to face because you have always been a truly isolated person, so that whatever you write will be good because it will be true, which is not so in my case. You immediately receive recognition because what you write is true in relation to yourself, which is always recognizable to the world outside. With me, who knows? When you are capable only of a serious approach to writing as I am, it is almost more than one can bear to be continually doubting one's own sincerity. Reading Jane Bowles' letters makes me angrier and sadder than anything to do with you. Because she was just so brilliant, and she was willing to take a crack at it, telling the truth about her difficult and contradictory life. And because she got it right, even though, like the artist Hannah Wilke, in her lifetime, she hardly found anyone to agree with her. You're the cowboy, I'm the kike. Steadfast and true, slippery and devious. We aren't anything but our circumstances. Why is it men become essentialists, especially in middle age? And at Joseph's party, time stands still and we can do it all again. Marshall walks me over to two men in suits, a Lacanian and a world banker from the UN. We talk about Microsoft and Bill Gates and Timothy Leary's brunches in L.A. until a tall and immaculately gorgeous WASP woman joins us, and the conversation parts away from jokes about interest rates and transference to make room for her. As I write this, I feel very hopeless and afraid. Later, Marshall made an academic birthday speech for Joseph that he'd been scribbling on all night. And Glenn O'Brien, looking like Steve Allen at the piano, performed a funny scat singing recitative about Joseph's legendary womanizing wealth and art. Everybody clapping, laughing, camp but serious and boozy like the film The Girl Can't Help It. Men in suits playing TV beatniks, but where's Jane Mansfield as the Fall Girl? Then David Byrne and John Cale played piano and guitar, and people danced. Silvera got drunk and teased Diego something about politics, and Diego got mad and tossed his drink in Silvera's face. And Warren Nieslewczowski was there, and John and Anya. Later, Marshall marshaled a gang of little men, the banker, the Lacanian, and Silvera, to the card room to drink scotch and talk about the Holocaust. The four looked like the famous velvet painting of card-playing dogs. And it got late, and someone turned on some vintage disco. And all the people young enough never to have heard these songs the first time round got up and danced. Funky Town, The Freak is Chic, and Upside Down. The songs that played in topless clubs and bars in the late 70s while these men were getting famous. While me and my friends, all the girls, were paying for our rent and shows and exploring issues of our sexuality by shaking to them all night long in topless bars.
Thank you. So I think we're going to take like a 10, 15 minute break and then come back. And Chris is going to read from more recent work. So hopefully you guys will all stick around. Thanks.
This is intense. It's hard work.
Yeah.
You didn't tell me this was going to be hard.